Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, Second Appellate District of Texas. Mr. Moses, and Mr. Gilstrap, please sit down. Just going to recognize you and say we're glad to have you this morning. Looking forward to having some heavy weights. This ought to be good. So I will ask the clerk to call the case and the docket. This is our only oral argument this morning. We have several others that will be submitted on briefs and that we'll conference on after the oral argument is over. And I don't know if you both know, I'm sure, that the arguments are recorded and the recordings will be available online probably by this afternoon. Okay. Mr. Gilstrap.
May it please the court. David Bowles approached our clients and offered to allow them to, quote, invest in his business of flipping houses. The idea is that we would give him money, he would buy houses, flip them, and pay the profits to us. Easy money. Well, it seemed convincing. He even gave notes and deeds of trust to the purported property that we had. And some people got paid. As it turns out, however, the whole thing was a fraud. The notes and deeds of trust were fraudulent, and the money that was used to pay early investors came from funds invested by later investors. It's a classic Ponzi scheme. And
did he ever buy any houses?
What's that?
Did he ever buy any houses?
Evidence that he ever acquired one house.
Okay.
A Ponzi scheme has to grow to stay afloat, and this one got enormous. And I have to look at my notes every time when I read this. In the Metro Buys account, one of his Wells Fargo's account, Bowles ran over $40 million in 4 years through that account. At the end of the day, many people, including our clients, were left holding the bag. Now, the bank says, oh gosh, all we did was act as conduit. We provided ordinary banking services and the account was just a conduit for Bowles. Well, it turned out in some ways it was a conduit into Wells Fargo's pocket because they wound up with a lot of the money. We don't know how much. Discovery of bank records is difficult and we hadn't completed it by the time the summary judgment hearing rolled around, but we do know that a lot of money was involved. It came from three sources. First of all, there were service charges. Secondly, there were loans. The bank would loan Bowles money, and they would take money out of the quote, investors' money out of the account to pay service those loans.
So when you're talking about loans, you're really talking about this insufficient.
Well, there are two kinds.
Okay.
There were actually some formal loans, some loan documents, I think a home equity loan, maybe some others, that he made, and that money, when it was time to pay it, they would just take the money out of the Metro Buys account. There were also overdrafts, and that's a loan, and there were significance, and arguably they kept the Ponzi scheme afloat. Finally, and most egregiously, the bank took something called bank-originated debits. They've never explained what they are, but they're huge. There are 2 months in which the bank-originated debits exceeded $80,000. We have 2 months based on incomplete records in which the bank took over $100,000 out of the accounts, and that is our money and we want it back. Our vehicle is what we call the trust fund doctrine, and it's based on two cases, famous cases, Steer against Stockyards Bank, National Indemnity versus Spring Branch Bank, and under those theories, we can obtain an accounting, disgorgement, and restitution of our funds from the bank.
Can you clarify? I'm not sure what Justice Sutherland was referring to, but was the money to Mr. Bowles or his company from the plaintiffs, were those characterized as loans?
Some of them were characterized as loans. There were formal loan documents. But in other cases, they would allow him to run large overdrafts. And they admitted that an overdraft is a loan. When you run an overdraft protection at your bank, the bank is loaning you money. And Stockyards Steer against Stockyards National Bank involved large overdrafts. That's the other kind of loan that they make.
I guess what I'm asking about is the relationship of the plaintiffs to Mr. Bowles. What kind of arrangement did they have for the money to go from the plaintiffs to the bank account? Were those loans or investments?
They would give him checks and he'd put the money in the Wells Fargo accounts. That's how they got the loans. There was no documentation other than the phony notes and deed of trust.
Okay.
Now, we understand trust fund theory now, but during the fog of litigation and discovery, we didn't discover it till late. And after the summary judgment motion had been filed by the bank and after it was set, we figured out that our principal claim was the trust fund doctrine. We amended. We've responded to the summary judgment motion by saying, you haven't addressed our trust fund doctrine claims.
Was trust fund doctrine ever uttered prior to that amendment 7 days before the summary judgment hearing?
I don't know, but I'm assuming that it wasn't. But the amendment was timely.
Right, but I'm just, had it been discussed, had it been discovered, had it been in any way pled?
I don't know that it has. I don't have any evidence that it had been. That's the best I can do on that. Now, we expected them to come back and say, wait a minute, we want to file a new summary judgment motion. They could have done that. And it would have cost a little time, but it wouldn't have cost as much time as this appeal's costing. Well, they didn't do that. They kind of brazenly toughed it out, said this involves nothing new. They filed a reply on the day before the hearing that addressed some of the issues. They've addressed some more in their brief. But they did not, except in one possible respect, they did not address our trust fund doctrine theory. And so for that reason, I submit that this is an easy reversal on procedural grounds. Now, if there's ever such thing as an easy reversal, they did arguably address one element of our trust fund doctrine claim. They say in their summary judgment motion that they're not liable because the Bowles accounts were ordinary deposit accounts, and they were ordinary deposit accounts. They weren't fiduciary accounts. They didn't say David Bowles trustee or David Bowles independent executor. They were just ordinary deposit accounts. The problem with the argument is that the trust fund doctrine applies to ordinary deposit accounts. Steer against Stockyards National Bank, National Indemnity against Spring Branch Bank, both involved ordinary deposit accounts. We've got other cases on pages 8 and 9 of the reply brief. The only possible ground that they had to defeat our trust fund theory fails. They don't have any other grounds in their summary judgment motion. End of story, reverse. But it shouldn't, I'm going to ask you not to stop at that point, because they'll just go back, refile their motion, we'll be back here in a year. This court has the discretion to prudently address some of the remaining issues, even though they cannot serve as a grounds for reversal, to instruct the trial court. And I'm asking you to do those. And I want to address a couple of those issues right now. First of all, we call it the trust fund doctrine. I don't know that any other cases actually use that name, but that's the best we could do. There's no accepted name for this, and it's unfortunate there's another trust fund doctrine involving corporations that's not applicable here. But the trust fund doctrine claims, what kind of funds does it cover? Does it cover any cases, any kind of funds? Well, certainly it covers funds held by a fiduciary, even though they're in an ordinary deposit account. And there is evidence, although Des discovery was incomplete, from which a jury could conclude that Bowles was our agent, because He said, I'll take your money, I'll put it in the into a deal and give you the money back. That at least gets to the jury on the question of agency. But we don't have to prove that the funds were fiduciary funds in order for the trust fund doctrine to be applicable. The test is whether the funds belong to a third party or are they being held for the benefit of a third party? A much broader test than fiduciary relationship. And certainly, the jury could conclude that these funds are, did belong to us, because they never changed. They just went into the bank and went out. He never bought a house. They say, well, gosh, we had the notes and deeds of trust, and that created a debtor-creditor relationship between Bowles and ourselves.
Held for the benefit of a third party, is it measured by subjective intent? Because I don't think Bowles would have been holding it for the benefit of anyone other than himself.
I think the jury could conclude that we thought it was being held.
So it has to do with whose intent?
Yes, I think so. I think you have to say that. Because obviously, if you don't, it would include cases of overt fraud where the guy implanted to steal it from the beginning.
Okay, so you
like this.
So you think that it the held for the benefit test is the person who tendered the funds to the
yes.
depositor?
Yes, I would think so.
Mr. Gilstrap, you mentioned a couple of times the notes and deeds of trust that some of the people that are your clients received.
Yes.
Help me a little bit with how those were structured. Were those deeds of trust or notes or deeds that held Mr. Bowles as the owner of the property and the grantor under the deed of trust?
Well, unfortunately, they're not in the record.
So no one knows what the structure of those deeds of trust were.
That's right. All we know is that he gave notes and deeds of trust.
And what evidence is in the record, or if there was any in the summary judgment record, that any person who was a recipient of paperwork that was supposed to be a deed or trust, was there any evidence that they ever took any of that in for a title examination?
There's no evidence that they did that. Bowles was not discovered. And one of the ways that Bowles was discovered is when two of the investors got together.
Yeah, I saw that in your
report. Notes.
Both of us got the same piece
of
property here.
Right. But the point is, they were totally bogus. They didn't mean anything.
Well, at least on those two documents that those two people discovered, they were both holding the same, quote, collateral, if we use that word loosely. Those at least were paper documents that could be looked at.
Well, they could be looked at by us, but there's no evidence the bank looked at them. There's no evidence the bank ever saw them. But the bank is saying that somehow that transformed our relationship with Bowles into a debtor-creditor relationship. Therefore, the funds weren't being held for us. The problem is it's fraudulent.
Well, that's true. The fraud that was conducted by Bowles at least got him money in the form of checks or whatever form that he was received fungible funds from the person who was giving him those funds or was delivering to him those funds, and then they were put in a bank account. Now, was this a contractual relationship between the people giving the money and the person receiving the money?
If it was, it was fraudulent. That's our whole point. Whatever the, quote, supposed relationship between the parties, between Bowles and the quote, investors, it was fraudulent. Yep. So fraud vitiates any relationship, and it vitiates any claim with the bank that this is somehow a debtor.
I'm just trying to put myself in my mind in the place of the person that Bowles is talking to try to get the money from.
And
just give me the money, and I'll go buy some houses with it, and then we'll make money.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of deals are done that way. In the real world, they are.
It's really a contract, isn't it? A verbal contract.
It's
not,
a ver-
but for the fraud, but for
yes,
the fraud.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a verbal contract, although I believe that part of that contract is that he's going to act as our agent. I think that's implicit in the contract. But, yes, it's a verbal contract, but it's all based on fraud.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Now, there's another issue here. What does the bank have to know? Well, the older cases, like Stockyards, say that say that they have to know or should have known. Well, here they did know or should have known. Christine Weingarner said she knew that those were investor funds. She was a bank officer. She told it to her superior, and they admit it in their brief. In their brief that they knew. But they don't have to know. Under national indemnity, the bank can be totally ignorant, and they have to disgorge the funds unless they can show they changed their position in detrimental reliance on their belief that Bowles owned the funds. That's the trust form doctrine in its truest form. See, nobody's hurt. They give us the money back. They still have their loans. No one's changed its position. That's what the holding of national indemnity is. And unless they can show that they changed their position, such as by paying the funds to a third party, they are trust funds and they're subject to disgorgement.
Well, you used the word investment, and I'm wondering what that means in this context, because investment could be I give my money to you to go buy me a house, but I'm paying for the house, so it becomes your money.
Well,
until you sell the house, and then we split the profits.
I've tried to put the term investor and investment in scare quotes all the way through, although sometimes I haven't failed. It doesn't make any difference. Whether it was, quote, an investment or not, it was fraudulent. The funds never changed character. They were just put in the bank. And that's all we need under the trust fund doctrine.
I have a question. You said that you don't want us to just reverse on procedural grounds, that in fact you want us to go beyond that, so that the other side has an opportunity to address what you're asking us to do. Would you, in bullet point, just tell us what it is you're asking us to do beyond reverse on procedural grounds?
I want you to state the test for determining whether funds are trust funds, and it's not whether they're fiduciary funds. It's, do the funds belong to a third party, or are they being held for the benefit of a third party? Secondly, I want you to articulate, first of all, the knowledge requirement of STEER, and then the easier standard of national indemnity, which doesn't require knowledge by the bank. That way, the trial judge will know where she should go with this case when it's remanded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moses, I don't like to do this, but I want to ask you a question before you start.
Okay.
If this court were to do as Mr. Gilstrap has just requested, would we be making law?
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. It's always interesting to be an appellee because I have a written spiel or speech presentation, and I never get to go by it, and Justice Myers was the perfect example. There's always questions or things that have come up in appellant's argument that I feel compelled to address. So first let me address some of the specific questions that you asked of counsel, and then I'll go to some of the points I really wanted to explain to the court as to why this case should be affirmed. First, you asked what was the actual setup of the loans or the transactions themselves, and the record does provide us with that information, and in fact, the record does confirm that all of the bank's records pertaining to the Metro accounts were provided to plaintiffs. They keep suggesting that there was a lot of discovery necessary. There were some 30-odd depositions taken, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on discovery. There was nothing left to be done other than have the trial court determine whether a cause of action existed. There's no question, and it's not the bank editorializing, that the relationship wasn't an oral contract as was suggested, but was actually a written contract from the perspective of the plaintiffs and Metro or Mr. Bowles. And there actually were some houses purchased to answer that question. Unfortunately, they were used as collateral on multiple loans. So that's the real universe of what the trial court was looking at, and that's the real universe of what Wells Fargo was dealing with. So what was the relationship between Mr. Bowles and each investor, within air quotes, as Mr. Gilstrap said, or what was their circumstance? In each instance, a deed of trust was provided along with a promissory note. Once that promissory note, once money was exchanged for that promissory note, you no longer have the trust fund doctrine, or what the courts in Texas have actually said, and I quote, the trust fund theory, which is an equitable remedy. It's not a cause of action, and that's key. It is a remedy. It's a means by which you can expunge funds that Wells Fargo specifically collected on its own behalf if there was some sort of trust, whether it be actual or constructive.
But if they raised the trust fund doctrine, the trust fund theory, wouldn't you be required to, and they raised it timely in their pleadings, wouldn't you be required then to seek either a special exception to challenge whether or not it's a cause of action, viable cause of action, or seek summary judgment on that theory? I mean, it seems like there was a step missed here. They pled it on the eve of summary judgment hearing, and then it was not addressed in the original summary judgment because it hadn't been pled yet, and it was neither attacked as a special exception or on summary judgment, yet disposed of by the trial court.
There was no reason to do so. In the case of Garza versus Garza, a 2010 decision out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals, which we cited in our brief, the court explained that when you've got a reply, when you have something in a reply that's not a new and independent grounds, but is which is subsumed by your initial grounds, there's no reason to seek a continuance or to have it specifically addressed.
And you know, I have not looked at that case. I know that with regard to negligence, when you're pleading shades of negligent acts, that is the case because it's still all negligence. But this seems to be a separate, purportedly a separate cause of action. Now, it may not actually be a cause of action in Texas, but it seems on its face to be pled as a separate cause of action.
But it's not. It's a means of recovering once you've determined that there's some sort of trust, whether it be constructive or actual. Another case on point is Community Initiatives, Inc. versus Chase Bank of Texas, a 2004 El Paso case, which we also cited in the brief. And it holds that when you're just replying to something that was raised in the response to the summary judgment, and it's a color or shade of what you've already addressed, there's, again, no need to seek a continuance or.
But didn't they actually amend their pleadings?
They did. But their amendment was just a specific, more detail as to why they believed there was some sort of trust.
So you're saying that this trust fund doctrines, trust fund theory, was actually not pled as a separate cause of action in the pleading that they filed on the eve of summary judgment hearing?
Justice Soth, we actually have two arguments in that regard. First is that it's not a new claim whatsoever. It's a means of recovering. It's a remedy. Our second theory is
I'm not asking what it is. I'm asking how they treated it in their pleadings.
But if this is a notice state, I don't think it matters if they call it a cause or they call it a remedy. You have to look at what it really is, and that's what it is. But if for some reason this court believed it wasn't a remedy and that it was a new cause, the case law in Texas still says if that cause was subsumed by the causes you did address, you don't have to replete it. So to answer the court's directed question, there's really two reasons we think that it's not a hurdle that hasn't been cleared. One, it's not a cause, it's a remedy, but if for some reason you don't agree with that, it's still subsumed by those causes which were directly addressed.
Particularly which causes? What causes subsume it?
Literally, all of their causes started with the claim of a Ponzi scheme. And they've dropped most of their causes, if the court's actually noted from their appellate brief. So the only things that they have left, in other words, they dropped you participated or you somehow conspired in the Ponzi scheme, they've left and aided in abetting, which I'll address if given time, although counsel didn't really address it in his arguments, that they dropped, you were negligent in how you operated the account, et cetera. So each of those claims still dealt with, at its heart, you had to have some sort of actual participation in a Ponzi scheme. And every court that's ever addressed a bank's obligations has said that you're going to turn the banking world on its head if you require them to look beyond the transactions. Again, it goes back to what Justice Meyer was discussing at the very beginning. You've got a debtor-creditor relationship. There is no fiduciary relationship between Mr. Bowles and any of these investors. There's no way to argue there wasn't. Under the trust fund theory or doctrine itself, the only reason it ever applies is if the money was given to the holder of the money for the benefit of the person who gave them the money. For instance, had these individuals said, Mr. Bowles, we want you to serve as a real estate agent or broker and go find a piece of property for us. We want you to purchase that in our name. While that money was in his hands, there's a constructive trust. Its title hasn't passed of that money from that investor to Mr. Bowles. In this instance, as soon as you took the promissory note, title did pass. The money no longer was those investors. It was Metro Buys Homes money, secured by a worthless piece of paper, a deed of trust, which was either pledged to multiple individuals if purchased or never existed whatsoever.
So I'm looking at a little bit more clinically than that. I'm saying that you filed a motion for summary judgment on several grounds. Of the grounds that you filed your motion for summary judgment on, which causes of actions that you attacked subsume the trust fund theory?
And literally every one, because every one of the causes of action we attacked dealt with the, at its forefront, you had to have some sort of constructive trust or actual trust in order for the monies to remain the plaintiffs.
And you just said a minute ago, does that equate with a fiduciary duty having been created?
No, you do. I agree that there's two different ways that the trust fund theory or doctrine, whatever we want to call it, can apply. You can either have a fiduciary relationship, or you can have a constructive trust, which then creates the fiduciary relationship, such that the title to the money didn't pass. For instance, the case that they liked, that Steer case, there was no question that that money did not belong to the Steer, to the broker of those cattle. What happened was, the broker actually had two separate accounts, the court may recall, an operating account and an account he used for his customers or clients. The money in the customer-client account, the bank was well aware they were taking customer-client cattle, selling it, that money would come in, the money really belonged to that customer-client, and then the broker would take a fee for his services. The other cases they rely upon, for instance, it was a real estate development. The name is escaping me, but if the court gives me one moment, I'll find it. It was a real estate development case, and I apologize, it's in the brief, but what happened again was you had a real estate developer, there were gonna be people investing in the money. The money was to go for this partnership or this joint venture, so the money remained the joint ventures. It never became the individual just holding the money because the funds were earmarked for a specific thing. It wasn't gonna be that individual's item, the development. It was going to be those who were participating, no different than the example I gave at the beginning, which is if each individual plaintiff said, I want you to buy this house in my name, and he was just holding the money and never moved to the next step of actually purchasing the house and then titling it in that plaintiff's name, you'd have a constructive trust. So those are the nuances. The Al-Anon case, which was a Texas gas case, is similar in that particular case. What happened was you had a gas distributor, and they had an obligation to collect the state's taxes on that gas, and so they created two separate entities so they could get a free float, basically. And so the money that the court held, of course, was the state's. When you take that money, for that tax money, it ultimately belongs to the state, and everybody knows that from the get-go. So each of the cases they suggest supports trust fund theory or trust fund doctrine is very distinguishable in that the title to that money never transferred, or there was actual notice of the money. The two cases, well, the Texas case that is probably closest on point is the Fleming versus Texas case, Texas Coastal Pasadena Bank case. And in that case, you had much more wrongdoing, if you're gonna say any wrongdoing, on behalf of the bank. You had a banker telling the individuals who were gonna invest that this guy was basically a good guy. He had a good business, although he didn't understand the business, and he had money in his accounts. But the court noted that if you required a bank to disclose this information, you're setting up a Hobson's choice that would automatically make the bank lose, irrespective of which side it takes. If it reports information about its account holder, it's violated the Texas Finance Code and federal law. If it fails to report that information about its account holder, then it's going to set itself up to be sued. And that's exactly what they're asking you to do. Ms. Weingartner's testimony that they want to rely so heavily upon isn't that she thought there was a Ponzi scheme. To the contrary, it was this guy had a lot of bounced checks. And actually, if you look at the record, I don't think there's any evidence of a loan other than a bounced check. So when you asked what were these loans, they are NSFs. That's what the record's going to indicate. And if you look at the record as to what these bank-originated debts are, those are debts that are prepaid payments of Mr. Bowles. They're not monies the bank is collecting. In other words, if he has a pre-set-up mortgage payment, it's all set up that way on the system. And they do have all the documents. So there's even if you were to reverse and remand on the trust fund theory or the trust fund doctrine, which you shouldn't, you're looking at a case, and I don't remember the specific dollar amount, but a $50,000 or less case, which was NSF fees and account costs, not any significant amount of money. But where I was going before is that under the Fleming case, what they said was if you require specific obligations in Ms. Weingartner to say, well, we knew there were a lot of bounced checks, we knew there were problems with the account, and she's supposed to report that to plaintiffs, she's just violated the law. She never knew there was a Ponzi scheme, and there's no evidence that anyone, including the plaintiffs, knew there was a Ponzi scheme until basically right when the feds indicted Mr. Bowles. So there's nothing the bank could have done. There's two cases out of Arizona and California that we've relied upon that are right on point. You've got situations where you've got a Ponzi scheme.
The bank didn't know and the investors didn't know until the feds indicted, how did the feds find out about it? Didn't they either find out from the bank or from the investors? I mean, they've got to find out from somebody.
I think the feds found out about it, and I don't know. I mean, now we're going way beyond the record, but I can.
No, but I mean, how do they got to have witnesses.
Well, I don't know if they saw significant funds, if there was a tax issue that they started snooping into. I really don't know, but I do know this. The bank didn't report. There is in the record that the bank didn't report it to the feds. The feds came in and froze accounts, and the bank then recognized there was a Ponzi scheme.
As I'm remembering sequence that Judge Sutter is talking about, wasn't the indictment after there was a filing of a bankruptcy?
That may be. I just don't recall, and the bankruptcy's not in the record either. I don't want to make a representation to this court that I don't know the answer to. I do know that based upon having deposed every plaintiff, they said they didn't know about it until after the accounts were frozen. And I know that having spoken with the bank and them having deposed the bankers who were involved, they didn't know until the feds came in and froze the accounts.
I want to finish with one last question. I won't ask any more. Your contention, as I was listening to you, was that there was paperwork on the investment arrangement between Mr. Bowles and the people who were delivering him money.
Every time. Fraudulent. I'm not going to disagree with counsel.
But it was paperwork. It wasn't oral.
Correct. There was a promissory note and a deed of trust.
All right. Thank you.
One other question. You said that everything was, you felt that the case was fully discovered. There was lots of discovery in the case. Was it ever discovered what these bank-originated debits were?
Did they ever ask specifically? I don't think so, but if you look, I know what they are because, again, I know how to read these account statements.
So you say that they had an opportunity to ask but never did?
Right.
Okay.
My time's up, so I'll thank the court, and I'll sit down.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Mr. Gilstrap, do you have a rebuttal?
It please the court. Will the court make new law? No. This falls right under the Steer again and national indemnity cases. Established law for many years. They avoid national indemnity like the plague because they don't have an answer, because there the bank simply has to disgorge the money. And that's what we're asking for here. Two of their theories remind me of the time that I was arguing in front of the Fifth Circuit and the great Pat Higginbotham leaned over the bench and said, counsel, I just don't think that theory will survive the discipline of writing. How are you going to write that there is some type of a debtor-creditor relationship here when everybody admits that the instruments were fraudulent? when everybody admits that the whole thing was fraudulent? How can a purported debtor-creditor relationship arise? It certainly couldn't arise between us and Bowles. Otherwise, Bowles wouldn't be doing 10 years in the federal pen. The bank can't hide behind the instruments either. That may sound good, but it won't survive the discipline of writing, I submit. Now, as to the summary judgment grounds, what we're saying is it's established law that summary judgment must be based on grounds asserted by the movement. And they asserted no grounds other than the one possibly involving ordinary deposit accounts. They asserted no grounds that would negate our trust fund doctrine theory, okay, a trust fund theory claim.
Gilstrap, tell me how far you would have the bank go in looking into the business of the people who make deposits at the bank from other people that's delivered money to them.
I don't think you have to say that we would. They have any duty to do that. They in fact did know here. Now that see, there's a difference between having a duty and actually having knowledge.
I understand.
They understand, but no.
How far? I mean, is the bank responsible for looking at every bank account, the setup to know that the use of the funds is not on some Ponzi scheme?
No, but where the funds, the bank accounts turn out can't contain trust funds, they are under a duty to disgorge them. That's all we're asking here.
How were these funds trust funds?
These were trust funds because we gave them to him and he did nothing with them other than put them into the bank. It didn't change. Obviously there's no debtor-creditor relationship because it's fraudulent. We just gave him our money. And
he
put it in the bank.
When I go to a stockbroker and make an order for a purchase of stock and I deliver cash to them and they put it in a bank account.
Yes.
That is a situation where I still owe that money that's in the stockbroker's account.
I think there would probably be a fairly comprehensive brokerage agreement that would defeat that argument. But absent an agreement, yes. Now, when they put it in stock, even in street name, I think the character changes.
Okay, thank you.
Finally, they do talk about the Arizona and California banking cases. There are specific banking statutes that they rely upon that are not available to the creditor to the bank in Texas. You don't have to go any further than the trust fund doctrine or trust fund theory cases. You simply have to reverse and make it clear that if we can prove up the trust fund doctrine, which I think we can, we get disgorgement. Everybody goes back to square one. We get our money. They have their claim against Bowles. That's how it should be, and they should not have taken the investors' money.
Mr. Gilstrap, last question from me. In terms of the national indemnity case, the defendant who took the money was the managing general agent for the company and was collecting premiums and putting them into an account that were clearly designated as between his agreement and the parties who were making the payments and the underwriting insurance company that were trust funds.
As between the agent and the insurance company, there was a formal fiduciary relationship, but the account was not denominated as a trust account. It was an ordinary business account. That's an important distinction. First one, the ordinary business account, was arguably the subject of their summary judgment motion. The second, what the relationship was between Bowles and us, was not the subject of the summary judgment motion.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you both, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and your extensive briefs. Very good work. And your case is submitted. Your case is submitted. Sorry. We will excuse you and thank you for being here, and we will adjourn for the day.